This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents Naked, written by David Sedaris, performed by the author and Amy Sedaris.
A plague of ticks. When the teacher asked if she might visit with my mother, I touched my nose 8 times to the surface of my desk.
May I take that as a yes?
She asked. According to her calculations, I had left my chair 28 times that day.
You're up and down like a flea. I turned my back for 2 minutes and there you are with your tongue pressed against that light switch. Maybe they do that where you're from, but here in my classroom we don't leave our seats and lick things whenever we please. That is Miss Chestnut's light switch, and she likes to keep it dry. Would you like me to come over to your house and put my tongue on your light switches? Well?
Miss Chestnut raised her faint, penciled eyebrows.
I'm asking you a question. Would you or would you not want me licking the light switches in your house?
I slipped off my shoe, pretending to examine the imprint on the heel.
You're gonna hit yourself over the head with that shoe, aren't you?
It wasn't hitting, it was tapping. But still, how would she know what I was about to do?
Heel marks all over your forehead,
she said, answering my silent question.
You should take a look in the mirror sometime. Shoes are dirty things. We wear them on our feet to protect ourselves against the sole. It's not healthy to hit ourselves over the head with shoes, is it?
I guessed that it was not.
Guess? This is not a game to be guessed at. I don't guess that it's dangerous to run into traffic with a paper sack over my head. There's no guesswork involved. These things are facts, not riddles.
She sat at her desk, continuing her lecture as she penned a brief letter.
I'd like to have a word with your mother. You do have one, don't you? I'm assuming you weren't raised by animals. Is she blind, your mother? Can she see the way you behave, or do you reserve your antics exclusively for Miss Chestnut?
She handed me the folded slip of paper.
You may go now. And on your way out the door, I'm asking you to please not bathe my light switch with your germ-ridden tongue. It's had a long day. We both have.
It was a short distance from the school to our rented house. No more than 637 steps, and on a good day I could make the trip in an hour, pausing every few feet to tongue a mailbox or touch whichever single leaf or blade of grass demanded my attention. If I were to lose count of my steps, I'd have to return to the school and begin again.
Back so soon?
The janitor would ask.
You just can't get enough of this place, can you?
He had it all wrong. I wanted to be at home more than anything. It was getting there that was the problem. I might touch the telephone pole at step 314 and then, 15 paces later, worry that I hadn't touched it in exactly the right spot. It needed to be touched again. I'd let my mind wander for one brief moment and then doubt had set in, causing me to question not just the telephone pole, but also the lawn ornament back at step 219. I'd have to go back and lick that concrete mushroom one more time, hoping its guardian wouldn't once again rush from our house shouting,
"Get your face out of my toadstool!"
It might be raining, or maybe I had to go to the bathroom, but running home was not an option. It was a long and complicated process that demanded an oppressive attention to detail. It wasn't that I enjoyed pressing my nose against the scalding hood of a parked car. Pleasure had nothing to do with it. A person had to do these things because nothing was worse than the anguish of not doing them. Bypass that mailbox and my brain would never for one moment let me forget it. I might be sitting at the dinner table, daring myself not to think about it, and the thought would revisit my mind. Don't think about it. But it would already be too late, and I knew then exactly what I had to do. Excusing myself to go to the bathroom, I'd walk out the front door and return to that mailbox. Not just touching, but jabbing, practically pounding on the thing because I thought I hated it so much. What I really hated, of course, was my mind. There must have been an off switch somewhere, but I was damned if I could find it. I didn't remember things being this way back north. Our family had been transferred from Endicott, New York, to Raleigh, North Carolina. A new home was under construction, but until it was finished, we were confined to a rental property built to resemble a plantation house. The building sat in a treeless, balding yard, its white columns promising a majesty the interior failed to deliver. The front door opened onto a dark, narrow hallway lined with bedrooms not much larger than the mattresses that furnished them.
"Our own little corner of hell," my mother said, fanning herself with one of the shingles littering the front yard.
Depressing as it was, arriving at the front stoop of the house meant that I had completed the first leg of that bitter-tasting journey to my bedroom. Once home, I would touch the front door 7 times with each elbow, a task made more difficult if there was anyone else around.
"Why don't you try the knob?"
my sister Lisa would say.
"That's what the rest of us do, and it seems to work for us."
Inside the house, there were switches and doorstops to be acknowledged. My bedroom was right there off the hallway, but first I had business to tend to. After kissing the 4th, 8th, and 12th carpeted stair, I wiped the cat hair off my lips and proceeded to the kitchen, where I was commanded to stroke the burners of the stove, press my nose against the refrigerator door, and arrange the percolator, toaster, and blender into a straight row. After making my rounds of the living room, it was time to kneel beside the banister and blindly jab a butter knife in the direction of my favorite electrical socket. There were bulbs to lick and bathroom faucets to test before finally I was free to enter my bedroom, where I would carefully align the objects on my dresser, lick the corners of my metal desk, and lie upon my bed, rocking back and forth and thinking what an odd woman she was, my third grade teacher, Miss Chestnut. Why come here and lick my light switches when she never even used the one she had? Maybe she was drunk. Her note had asked if she might visit our home in order to discuss what she referred to as my special problems. My mother placed a letter upon the table and lit a cigarette. "Have you been leaving your seat to lick the light switch?" "Once or twice," I said. "Once or twice what? Every half hour? Every 10 minutes? "I don't know," I lied. "Who's counting?" "Well, your goddamn math teacher, for one. That's her job to count. What, you think she's not going to notice?" "Notice what?" It never failed to amaze me that people might notice these things. Because my actions were so intensely private, I had always assumed they were somehow invisible. When cornered, I demanded that the witness had been mistaken. "What do you mean, notice what? I got a phone call just this afternoon from that lady up the street, that Mrs. Keening, the one with the twins. She says she caught you in her front yard, down on your hands and knees, kissing the evening edition of her newspaper." "I wasn't kissing it. I was just trying to read the headline." "And you had to get that close? Maybe we need to get you some stronger glasses." "Well, maybe we do," I said. "And I suppose this Miss..." My mother unfolded the letter and studied the signature. "This Miss Chestnut is mistaken, too? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Maybe she has you confused with the other boy who leaves his seat to lick the pencil sharpener or touch the flag or whatever the hell it is you do the moment her back is turned?" "That's very likely," I said. "She's old. There are spots on her hands." "Yeah? How many?" my mother asked. On the afternoon that Miss Chestnut arrived for her visit, I was in my bedroom rocking. Unlike the obsessive counting and touching, rocking was not a mandatory duty, but a voluntary and highly pleasurable exercise. It was my hobby, and there was nothing else I would rather do. The point was not to rock oneself to sleep. This was not a step towards some greater goal. It was the goal itself. The perpetual movement freed my mind, allowing me to mull things over and construct elaborately detailed fantasies. Toss in a radio, and I was content to rock until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, listening to the hit parade and discovering that each and every song was about me. I might have to listen 200 or 300 times to the same song, but sooner or later its private message would reveal itself. Because it was pleasant and relaxing, my rocking was bound to be tripped up, most often by my brain, which refused to allow me more than 10 consecutive minutes of happiness. When Miss Chestnut arrived, I cracked open my bedroom door, watching as my mother invited her in. "You'll have to forgive me for these boxes,"
My mother flicked her cigarette out the door and into the littered yard. They're filled with crap, every last one of them, but God forbid we throw anything away. Anyway, to hell with it. You look like I need a drink. Scotch all right? Miss Chestnut's eyes brightened.
I really shouldn't, but, oh, why not?
She followed my mother up the stairs.
Just a drop with ice, no water.
I tried rocking in bed, but the sound of laughter drew me to the top of the landing, where, from my vantage point behind an oversized wardrobe box, I watched the two women discuss my behavior. Oh, you mean the touching, my mother said. She studied the ashtray that sat before her on the table, narrowing her eyes much like a cat catching sight of a squirrel. Her look of fixed concentration suggested that nothing else mattered. Time had stopped, and she was deaf to the sounds of the rattling fan and my sister's squabbling out in the driveway. She opened her mouth just slightly, running her tongue over her upper lip, and then she inched forward, her index finger prodding the ashtray as though it were a sleeping thing she was trying to wake. I had never seen myself in action, but a sharp, stinging sense of recognition told me that my mother's impersonation had been accurate.
Priceless.
Miss Chestnut laughed, clasping her hands in delight.
Oh, that's very good. You've captured him perfectly. Bravo. I give you an A+.
God only knows where he gets it from, my mother said. He's probably down in his room right this minute, counting his eyelashes or gnawing at the pulls on his dresser. The kid's wound too tight, but he'll come out of it. So what do you say? Another scotch, Catherine? Now she was Catherine. Another few drinks and she'd probably be joining us on our summer vacation. How easy it was for adults to bond over a second round of cocktails. I returned to my bed, cranking up the radio so as not to be distracted by the sounds of their cackling. Because Miss Chestnut was here in my home, I knew it was only a matter of time before the voices would order me to enter the kitchen and make a spectacle of myself. Maybe I'd have to suck on the broom handle, or stand on the table, or touch the overhead light fixture, but whatever was demanded of me, I had no choice but to do it. Following Miss Chestnut's visit, my father attempted to cure me with a series of threats. You touch your nose to that windshield one more time and I'll guarantee you wish you hadn't, he said, driving home from the grocery store with a lap full of rejected out-of-state coupons. It was virtually impossible for me to ride in the passenger seat of a car and not press my nose against the windshield, and now that the activity had been forbidden, I wanted it more than anything. I tried closing my eyes, hoping that might eliminate my desire, but I found myself thinking that perhaps he was the one who should close his eyes. So what if I wanted to touch my nose to the windshield? Who was it hurting? Why was it that he could repeatedly worry his change and bite his lower lip without the threat of punishment? My mother smoked, and Miss Chestnut massaged her waist 20-30 times a day, and here I couldn't press my nose against the windshield of a car? I opened my eyes, defiant, but when he caught me moving towards my target, my father slammed on the brakes. You like that, did you? He handed me a golf towel to wipe the blood from my nose. Did you like the feel of that? Like was too feeble for what I felt. I loved it. If mashed with the right amount of force, a blow to the nose can be positively narcotic. Touching objects satisfied a mental itch, but the task involved a great deal of movement. Run upstairs, cross the room, remove a shoe. I soon found these same urges could be fulfilled within the confines of my own body. Punching myself in the nose was a good place to start, but the practice was dropped when I began rolling my eyes deep in their sockets, an exercise that produced quick jolts of dull, intoxicating pain. I know exactly what you're talking about, my mother said to Mrs. Schatz, my visiting fourth grade teacher. The eyes rolling every which way, it's like talking to a slot machine. Hopefully one day it'll pay off, but until then, what do you say we have ourselves another glass of wine? Hey, sport, my father said. If you're trying to get a good look at the contents of your skull, I can tell you right now that you're wasting your time. There's nothing there to look at, and these report cards prove it. He was right. I had my nose pressed to the door, the carpet, and the windshield, but not, apparently, to the grindstone. School held no interest whatsoever.
I spent my days waiting to return to the dark bedroom of our new house where I could roll my eyes, listen to the radio, and rock in peace. Have a seat and let me get you something cool to drink. My mother would leave my fifth and then my sixth grade teacher standing in the breakfast nook while she stepped into the kitchen to crack open a tray of ice. I'm guessing you're here about the head shaking, am I right? She'd shout. That's my boy, all right. No flies on him. She suggested my teachers interpret my jerking head as a nod of agreement. That's what I do, and now I've got him washing the dishes for the next 5 years. I ask, he yanks his head, and it's settled. This was part of my mother's act. She played the ringleader, blowing the whistle and charming the crowd with her jokes and exaggerated stories. When company came, she often pretended to forget the names of her six children. Hey, George or Agnes, whatever your name is, how about running into the bedroom and finding my cigarette lighter? She noticed my tics and habits, but was never ashamed or seriously bothered by any of them. Her observations would be collected and delivered as part of a routine that bore little resemblance to our lives. It's a real stretch, but I'm betting you're here about the tiny voices, she said, offering a glass of sherry to my visiting seventh grade teacher. I'm thinking of either taking him to an exorcist or buying him a doll so he can bring home some money as a ventriloquist. It had come out of nowhere, my desperate urge to summon high-pitched noises from the back of my throat. These were not words, but sounds that satisfied an urge I'd never before realized. The sounds were delivered not in my voice, but in that of a thimble-sized, temperamental diva clinging to the base of my uvula. I was a host to these wailings, but lacked the ability to control them. I'd like to think that some of my nervous habits faded during high school, but my class pictures tell a different story. Well, draw in the missing eyeballs and this one might not be so bad, my mother would say. In group shots, I was easily identified as the blur in the back row. For a time, I thought that if I accompanied my habits with an outlandish wardrobe, I might be viewed as eccentric rather than just plain retarded. I was wrong. Only a confirmed idiot would wander the halls of my high school dressed in a floor-length caftan. As for the countless medallions that hung around my neck, I might as well have worn a cowbell. They clanged and jangled with every jerk of my head, calling attention when without them I might have passed unnoticed. My oversized glasses did nothing but provide a clearer view of my rolling, twitching eyes, and the clunky platform shoes left lumps when used to discreetly tap my forehead. I was a mess. I could be wrong, but according to my calculations, I got exactly 14 minutes of sleep during my entire first year of college. I'd always had my own bedroom, a meticulously clean and well-ordered place where I could practice my habits in private. Now I would have a roommate, some complete stranger spoiling my routine with his God-given right to exist. The idea was mortifying, and I arrived at the university in full tilt. The doctors tell me that if I knock it around hard enough, there's a good chance the brain tumor will shrink to the point where they won't have to operate, I said the first time my roommate caught me jerking my head. Meanwhile, these other specialists have me doing these eye exercises to strengthen what they call my corneal fibers, whatever that means. They've got me coming and going, but what can you do, right? Anyway, you go ahead and settle in. I think I'll just test this electrical socket with a butter knife and rearrange a few of the items on my dresser. Easy does it. That's what I always say. It was hard enough coming up with excuses, but the real agony came when I was forced to give up rocking. Give it a rest, Romeo, my roommate moaned the first night he heard my bed springs creak. He thought I was masturbating, and while I wanted to set the record straight, something told me I wouldn't score any points by telling him that I was simply rocking in bed, just like any other 18-year-old college student. It was torture to lie there doing nothing. Having memorized my roommate's course schedule, I took to rushing back to the room between classes, rocking in fitful spurts but never really enjoying it for fear he might return at any moment. When my roommate went out of town, I would spend the entire weekend rocking in bed and fantasizing about his tragic car accident. College is the best thing that can ever happen to you, my father used to say, and he was right, for it was there that I discovered drugs, drinking, and smoking. I'm unsure of the scientific aspects, but for some reason, my nervous habits faded at around the same time I took up with cigarettes. Maybe it was coincidental, or perhaps the tics retreated in the face of an adversary that, despite its health risks, is much more socially acceptable than crying out in tiny voices. Were I not smoking, I'd probably be on some sort of medication that would cost the same amount of money, but deny me the accoutrements. The lighters I can thoughtlessly open and close, the ashtrays that provide me with a legitimate reason to leave my chair, and the cigarettes that calm me down while giving me something to do with my hands and mouth. It's as if I'd been born to smoke, and until I realized it, my limbs were left to search for some alternative. Everything's fine as long as I know there's a cigarette in my immediate future. The people who ask me not to smoke in their cars have no idea what they're in for. Get your yayas out. It was for many years my family's habit to drive from North Carolina to western New York State to visit the relatives we had left behind. After spending 10 days with my mother's family in Binghamton, we would drive the half hour to Cortland and spend an afternoon with my father's mother, the woman we addressed as Yaya. Yaya owned a combination newsstand candy store, a long, narrow room fitted with magazine racks, and the high, wall-mounted chairs the townspeople occupied while receiving their shoe shines. She lived above the store in an apartment my father had grown up in. A shithole, my mother said, and even at the age of 7, I thought, yes, she's right, this is a shithole. I spent my time at Yaya's wondering what this place might have been before someone got the cruel idea to rent it out as an apartment. The dark, stifling hallway had been miscast in the role of a kitchen, and the bathroom looked suspiciously like a closet. I recall one visit when she carried on about her recently deceased pet, a common goldfish she kept in a murky jar upon the apartment's only window ledge. Yaya had returned from work and, finding the jar empty, decided that the fish had consciously thrown itself out the window.
He no happy no more, and think to have a suicide, she said.
Commit, my mother said. He committed suicide. She threw her cigarette butt out the window and stared down into the littered alley below. You don't have a suicide. It has you.
Okay,
Yaya said.
But why he have the suicide? He's pretty, the fish. Why he want to take he life away?
You're asking why? My mother lowered her sunglasses. Open your eyes and take a lucky guess. She emptied the jar into the sink. Jesus, this place is a dump. What Sharon means, my father said, is that a fish is incapable of thinking in those terms. They have tiny little cephales and don't get depressed. When speaking to his mother, my father used his loudest voice, drifting in and out of Pidgin Greek. The sorry didn't know any better. It wasn't your fault, Matera. It was Alados.
He had the suicide, and now I sad sometime.
Yaya stared out into the distance and sighed. I imagine she had spoken to the fish, had loved it as best she knew how, but her affection, like her cooking, was devoid of anything one might think of as normal. She regarded her grandchildren as if we were savings bonds, something certain to multiply in value through the majesty of arithmetic. Yaya and her husband had produced one child, who in turn had yielded 5, a wealth of hardy field hands destined to return to the village, where we might crush olives or stucco windmills or whatever it was they did in her hometown. She was always pushing up our sleeves to examine our muscles, frowning at the sight of our girlish, uncalloused hands. Whereas our other grandparents asked what grade we were in or which was our favorite ashtray, Yaya never expressed any interest in that sort of thing. Childhood was something you endured until you were old enough to work, and money was the only thing that mattered. She would sooner iron a stack of dollar bills than open any of the magazines or newspapers that lined the walls of her store. She didn't know who the president was, much less the central characters in any of her best-selling comic books.
"I don't know the Jughead,"
she'd say, spit-shining the keys on her cash register. It was difficult to imagine her raising a child of her own, and chilling to realize that she had. As a baby, my father had been confined to a grim corner of the newsstand, where he crawled on a carpet of newspapers, teething on nickels. He never had a bed, much less his own room, and considered himself lucky when the visitors left and he had the couch all to himself. Our dog had it better than that. The girl was what Yaya called my mother. My parents had been married 12 years, and she still couldn't bring herself to call her daughter-in-law by name. My father had made the mistake of marrying an outsider, and it was my mother's lot to suffer the consequences. She had somehow tricked him, sunk in her claws, and dragged him away from his people. It would have been all right for him to remain at home for the rest of his life, massaging worry beads and drinking bitter coffee, but to marry a woman with 2 distinct eyebrows was unpardonable.
"Tell the girl she can sit down now,"
Yaya would say to my father, pointing to a stool on the far side of the room. "Tell the gnome I won't be staying that long," my mother would respond. "Her cave's a little on the dingy side, and I think I might have an allergy to her mustache." We would pass the afternoon at Yaya's table, eating stringy boiled meat served with spinach pie. The food tasted as though it had been cooked weeks beforehand and left to age in a musty trunk. Her meals had been marinated in something dank and foreign, and were cooked not in pots and pans, but in the same blackened kettles used by witches. Once we'd been served, she performed an epic version of grace, delivered in both Greek and broken English. It involved tears and excessive hand-wringing and came off sounding less like a prayer than a spell. "Enough of the chanting," my mother would say, pushing away her plate. "Tell her I'll disappear as soon as my kids are fed." More often than not, my mother left the table and waited outside in the car until we had finished our meal.
"The girl go away now,"
Yaya would say, raising her glass of ginger ale.
"Okay, stofai. Now we eat."
Our visits concluded with an all-you-could-grab assault on the store. "You can each take one thing," my father said. My sisters and I carried bags and pillowcases, clearing the shelves of comic books. We stuffed our socks and pockets with candy and popcorn for the 12-hour ride back home, overpowering the car with the scent of newsprint and Yaya's spooky love. My mother was pregnant with her 6th child when we received the news that Yaya had been hit by a truck. She'd stood wide-eyed in the center of the street, staring down an advancing 18-wheeler driven by someone bearing a remarkable resemblance to my mother. That was the way I pictured it. The truth was considerably less dramatic. It seems she had been bumped by a pickup truck as it backed into a parking space. The impact was next to nothing, but she'd broken her hip in the fall. "That's a shame," my mother said, admiring her newly frosted hair in the bathroom mirror. "I guess now they'll have to shoot her." My father flew to Cortland and returned, announcing that once she'd recovered, Yaya would be moving in with us. "We'll move a few of the girls downstairs to the basement, and Yaya can take the bedroom across the hall from your mother and me. Won't that be fun?" He tried his best to make it sound madcap and adventurous, but the poor man wasn't fooling anyone, least of all my mother. "What's wrong with a nursing home?" she asked. "That's what normal people do. Better yet, you could lease her out to a petting zoo. Smuggle her aboard a tanker and ship her back to the old country, why don't you? Hire her a full-time babysitter, enlist her in the goddamn Peace Corps, buy her a camper and teach her to drive. All I know is that she's not moving in here. Do you understand me? There's no way I'll have her moping around my house, buddy. No way in hell." We had lived in our house for 2 years, and it still smelled new until Yaya moved in with her blankets and trunks and mildewed, overstuffed chairs that carried the unmistakable scent of her old apartment. Overnight, our home smelled like the cloakroom at the Greek Orthodox Church. It's the incense, my mother said. Tell her she's not allowed to burn any more of that stinking myrrh in her bedroom.
Tell the girl to give me back the matches,
Yaya said. Her first Sunday in our church, Yaya stopped the service when she tossed aside her cane and crawled up the aisle on her hands and knees. The priest saw her coming, and we watched as he nervously shifted his eyes, taking one step back, then another, and another. The man was pinned against the altar when Yaya finally caught up with him, caressing and ultimately kissing his shoes. Someone needed to step forward and take charge of the situation, but my mother was at home asleep and my father was at the golf course. That left my sisters and me, and we wanted no part of it. Members of the congregation turned their heads, searching for the next of kin, and we followed suit. Beats me, we said.
I've never seen her before in my life.
Maybe she's with the Stravitis. Yaya accepted the women in my family as another of life's little disappointments. Girls were to be tolerated, but every boy was a king, meant to be pampered and stuffed full of sour balls. She was overcome with joy when my mother gave birth to her final child, a boy Yaya wanted to name Hercules.
Polakimu,
she would say, pressing a 50-cent piece into my hand.
Polakimu Krisom.
This was her standard pet name, which roughly translated to my dearest little golden bird in a nest.
You go get the baby now, and we feed him some candy.
My brother and I came to view our Yaya as a primitive version of an ATM machine. She was always good for a dollar or two, and because we were boys, all we had to do was open her car door or inform her that the incense had just set fire to one of her embroidered cushions. I'd learned never to accompany her in public, but aside from that, Yaya and I had no problem. I saw her as a benign ghost, silent and invisible until you needed a little spending money. One could always change the channel while Yaya was watching TV. There was no need to even ask. She could go from the State of the Union address to a Bullwinkle cartoon without even noticing the difference. You might sit with her in the living room, but never were you forced to fetch her snacks or acknowledge her in any way. That was our mother's job, not ours. Every now and then she'd leave the yard and the neighbors would call saying,
"Did you know your grandmother's over here picking things out of our front yard?"
We'd hand the phone to our mother. "They're probably just dandelions," she'd say, drawing her hands on her skirt. "Don't worry, we won't charge you for the labor." "You'd think we never fed her," my mother would complain once my father returned from work. "She's out there gathering nuts and eating sunflower seeds out of the shirk's bird feeder. It's embarrassing." Yaya would wander off and return with an apron full of greens, which she would boil to a paste. "That's all right," we'd say, covering our plates at the sight of her advancing kettle. "I'm sure they're delicious, but I'm saving room for those toadstools you found beneath the Steigerwald's doghouse." The longer Yaya lived with us, the more distant my mother became. As children, we had worshipped her as a great beauty, but the strain of six children and a mother-in-law had begun to take its toll. The glass of wine with dinner was now preceded and followed by a series of cocktails that tended to fortify her rage. Rather than joining us at the table, she took to eating perched on a stool in the breakfast nook, wearing dark glasses and grinding out her cigarette on the edge of her plate. Yaya had been diagnosed with diabetes, and it was my mother's thankless job to prepare a special diet and cart her around town for her numerous doctor's appointments. It was my mother who practiced injecting insulin into oranges and doled out the pills. She was the one forced to hide the peanut butter and confiscate the candy hidden in Yaya's dresser drawers, all this for a woman who still refused to call her by name. My father would return home at the end of the day and listen to bitter complaints delivered in two harsh languages. My mother offered to sell the baby, to take a part-time job picking tobacco, anything to raise enough money for a nursing home, but even the cat understood that my father could not place his mother in an institution. It was against his religion. Greeks just didn't do things like that. They were too cheap. That's what had always kept their families together. The whole notion of a nursing home was something dreamt up by people like my mother, American women with sunglasses always searching for their tanning lotion or cigarette lighters. He couldn't evict his mother, but neither could he care for her.
The conflict divided our family into two distinct camps. My mother and sisters shouted from one corner, while my brother, father, and I jangled our change in the other. The children formed a committee, meeting in the driveway to discuss our parents' certain divorce. Who would my mother take with her when she left? If we went with our father and Yaya, we could be assured of our privacy, but what did it matter when our mother's attention was what we lived for? My mother had a wealthy aunt, a calculating and ambitious woman who had married the founders of two Cleveland department stores. The woman died, paranoid and childless, leaving the bulk of her estate to my mother, her sister, and a handful of nieces. Having money of her own provided my mother with a newfound leverage. She took to wandering the house in a white mink cape, reading aloud from the various real estate brochures provided by a man who arrived late one afternoon, introducing himself as her broker. "This one's got a full-size redwood sauna, separate bedrooms for each of my children, and a view of the distant volcanoes. It reads, 'Divorcees welcome, no Greeks allowed.' Oh, it sounds perfect, don't you think?" The money made her formidable, and within a month it was decided that Yaya would be sent to a nursing home. My father packed her belongings into the station wagon, and we followed behind in my great-aunt's Cadillac, fighting over who would use the fake fur throw. Yaya went first to a private facility, where she shared a room with a sprightly, white-haired lunatic named Mrs. DiNardo, who crept out of bed late at night to shit in the hamper and hide Yaya's dentures in the chilly tank of the toilet.
"I'm the stepsister of Jesus Christ, sent back to earth to round up all the lazy goddamn niggers and teach them to cook ribs the way that was meant to be cooked, goddammit!"
We were enchanted and took to giving her gifts meant for Yaya.
"What's this? A sack of almonds, you say? You can take these and shove them right up your puckered poo holes for all I care. I don't want nuts, motherfucker. I want drapes and shoes to match."
Once the construction was completed, Yaya moved into a spanking new building reserved exclusively for senior citizens, a high-rise development called Capitol Towers. The apartments featured metallic wallpaper and modish, asymmetrical rooms, the wall-to-wall windows offering a view of the local mall. No one in Raleigh lived in a high-rise, and we found ourselves briefly captivated by the glamour. My sisters and I fought for the opportunity to spend the night in Yaya's swinging clubhouse, and one by one we took our turns, standing at the darkened windows, swirling a mocktail and pretending to be mesmerized by the glittering lights of North Hills. I enjoyed pretending that this was my apartment and that Yaya was just visiting. "This is where I'll be putting the wet bar," I'd say, pointing to the shabby dinette set. "The movie projector will go here in the corner beside the shrine, and we'll knock down this dividing wall to build a conversation pit."
"Okay."
Yaya would stare at her folded hands.
"You make a pit."
Again, my father hoped Yaya might make some friends, but the women of Capitol Towers tended to be short-haired modern grandmothers with compact cars and stylish denim pantsuits. Yaya left her apartment only to ransack the community garden or sit quietly sobbing in the lobby, drying her tears with the tissue used to sculpt the latest holiday display. This was not the picture Capitol Towers wished to present. These were robust seniors, hoping to make the most of their retirement, and the sight of our grieving, black-clad Yaya deflated their spirits. It was suggested by the management that perhaps she might be more comfortable someplace else. Yaya took up residence at Mayview, a low-brick nursing home located next door to the old county poorhouse. This was an older, considerably less mobile crowd than she'd known at Capitol Towers. Many of the residents were confined to wheelchairs, their spotted scalps visible through tufts of unkempt hair. Unlike her former home, Mayview made no attempt to disguise the inevitable. There was no talk of one's well-deserved golden years. No rented buses or craft carnivals. This was it, the end of the line. All passengers, please double-check the overhead storage bin before disembarking. Yaya's husband, the man we had addressed as Papu, had been just as morose as she was. We had to turn their photographs upside down in order to catch them smiling.
The fact that they had only one child told us everything we needed to know about their erotic life. He worked, she worked, their child worked. They never expected anything more out of life. Papu had died when I was 6 years old. He'd been at the newsstand late one night when intruders hit him over the head with a lead pipe, rupturing a vein in his head. He was carried to the hospital and died on Christmas Day. "Did you still open presents?" we asked. "After he died, did he crap in his pants? Did the thieves concentrate only on money, or did they take magazines and candy bars while they were at it? Did they catch him? Did he go to the electric chair?"
"He go to Jesus now,"
Yaya would say. End of story. We asked our dad, who said only, "He was my father and I loved him." This was not the information we were looking for, but to this day, it is the only response he provides. "Of course you love your Yaya," he would say. "She's your grandmother." He stated as a natural consequence when to our mind, that was hardly the case. Someone might be your blood relative, but that didn't mean you had to love her. Our magazine articles and afternoon talk shows were teaching us that people had to earn their love from one day to the next. My father's family relied on a set of rules that no longer applied. It wasn't enough to provide your children with a home and hand them over all your loose change. A person had to be fun while doing it. For Yaya, it was already too late, but there was still some time for my father, who over the next few years grew increasingly nervous. He observed my mother holding court in the bedroom, wondering how she did it. She might occasionally snap, but once the smoke had cleared, we were back at her feet, fighting for her attention. I was in the second year of college when I received the news that Yaya had died. My mother called to tell me. I cradled the phone beneath my chin, a joint in one hand and a beer in the other, and noticed the time, 11:22 a.m. My roommate was listening in, and because I wanted to impress him as a sensitive and complex individual, I threw myself onto the bed and made the most of my grief.
"It can't be true," I cried. "It can't be true."
My sob sounded as if I were reading them off a page. "I've got just the thing for you, bud," my roommate said. "Just a thing for you and me both, because I don't know if I told you this, but my own grandmother died just a few months ago. My brother dropped by to do his laundry, and there she was, stretched out dead in front of her trophy case. That shit is harsh, my friend. You and me have got some grieving to do, and I've got just the thing to set free the spirit." His remedy involved two hits of acid, a bag of ice cubes, and a needle. We split a pair of gold posts and sat hallucinating in the dormitory kitchen as the criminal justice major pierced our ears. I flew home to Raleigh the next day, where my father said, "There's no way you're coming into my house with an earring. No, sir, no way." I spent the next several hours in the carport, threatening to sleep in the station wagon, unwilling to compromise myself for the likes of him. "Asshole," I shouted. "Nazi." "Listen," my mother said, stepping out the door with a tray of marble-sized meatballs. "You take the earring out, we go to the funeral, you stick it back in before you catch your plane. The hole won't close up that quickly, take my word for it. This is something I want you to do for your father, all right?" She set the tray upon the hood of the car and picked up a meatball, studying it for a moment. "Besides that, an earring looks really stupid combined with glasses. It sends a mixed message, and the effect is, well, it's troubling. Give me the earring and I'll put it away for you. Then I want you to come inside and help me straighten up the house. The Greeks will be here tomorrow afternoon, and we need to hide the booze." I removed the earring and never wore it again. Looking back, it shames me that I chose that particular moment to make a stand. My father had just lost his only mother, and I assumed that, like the rest of us, he felt nothing but relief. He'd been cut loose from his Greek anchor and could now drift freely through our invigorating American waters.
Yaya left behind no money or real estate. No priceless recipes or valuable keepsakes. Nothing but a sense of release. And what sort of a legacy was that? I can't help but imagine she had started off with loftier goals. As a young girl in Greece, she must have laughed at private jokes and entertained crushes on young stonemasons named Xerxes or Prometheus. When told she would be sent to the New World, I hope she took a few hours to imagine a life of cakes and servants, where someone else would shine her shoes and iron the money. Life had sentenced her to die alone among strangers. "When I get like that, I want you to shoot me. No questions asked," my mother whispered. "Disconnect the feeding tubes and shut off the monitors, but under no circumstances do I want you to move me into your basement." We nodded at the casket, my brother, my sisters, and I, knowing that with her, it would never come to that. Our father, on the other hand, the man weeping in the front row, he would prove to be much more difficult. Next of Kin. I found the book hidden in the woods beneath a sheet of plywood, its cover torn away and the pages damp with mildew. Brock and Bonnie Rivers stood in the driveway, waving goodbye to the Reverend Hasselbeck. "Goodbye," they said, waving. "Goodbye," the Reverend responded. "Tell those two teens of yours, Josh and Sandy, that they'll make an excellent addition to our young person's ministry. They're fine kids," he said with a wink. "Almost as fine and foxy as their parents." The Rivers chuckled, raising their hands in another wave. When the Reverend's car finally left the driveway, they stood for a moment in the bright sunshine before descending into the basement dungeon to unshackle the children. The theme of the book was that people are not always what they seem. Highly respected in their upper middle class community, the Rivers family practice a literal interpretation of the phrase, "love thy neighbor." Limber as gymnasts, these people were both shameless and insatiable. Father and daughter, brother and sister, mother and son. After exhausting every possible combination, they widened their circle to include horny sea captains and door-to-door knife salesmen. They did it in caves with their Doberman pincher and on the slanted roof with the construction crew hired to replace the shingles. The first two times I read the book, I found myself aching with pleasure. Yes, these people were naughty, but at the age of 13, I couldn't help but admire their infectious energy and spirited enjoyment of life. The third time I read it, I came away shocked, not by the characters' behavior, but by the innumerable typos. Had nobody bothered to proofread this book before sending it to print? In the opening chapter, the daughter is caught with her brother's keck and her pissy, calling out, feck me harder. When on page 33 the son has sex with his mother, he leaves the woman's tots glistening with jasm. I showed the book to my sister Lisa, who tore it from my hand, saying,
"Let me hold on to this for a while."
The book went from Lisa to our 11-year-old sister Gretchen, who interpreted it as a startling nonfiction expose of the American middle class. "I'm pretty sure this exact same thing is going on right here in North Hills," she whispered, tucking the book beneath the artificial grass of her Easter basket. "Take the Sherman family, for instance. Just last week, I saw Heidi sticking her hands down Steve Jr.'s pants."
"The guy has two broken arms," I said. "She was probably just tucking in his shirt."
"Would you ask one of us to tuck in your shirt?" she asked. She had a point. A veil had been lifted, especially for Gretchen, who now saw the world as a steaming pit of unbridled sexuality. Seated on a lounge chair at the country club, she would narrow her eyes, speculating on the children crowding the shallow end of the pool. "I have a sneaking suspicion Christina Youngblood might be our half-sister. She's got her father's chin, but the eyes and mouth are pure mom." I felt uneasy implicating our parents, but Gretchen provided a wealth of frightening evidence. She noted the way our mother applied lipstick at the approach of the potato chip delivery man, whom she addressed by first name and often invited in to use our bathroom. Our father referred to the bank tellers as doll or sweetheart, and their response suggested that he had taken advantage of them one time too many. The Greek Orthodox Church, the gaily dressed couples at the country club, even our elderly collie, Duchess, they were all in on it, according to Gretchen, who took to piling furniture against her bedroom door before going to sleep each night. The book wound up in the hands of our 10-year-old sister Amy, who used it as a textbook in the make-believe class she held after school each day. Dressed in a wig and high heels, she passed her late afternoon standing before a blackboard and imitating her teachers.
I'm very sorry, Candace, but I'm going to have to fail you,
she would say, addressing one of the empty folding chairs arranged before her.
The problem is not that you don't try. The problem is that, well, you're stupid. All right, class, now I'm going to read to you from this week's new book. It's a story about a California family entitled Next of Kin.
If Amy had read the book, then surely it had been seen by 8-year-old Tiffany, who shared her bedroom, and possibly by our brother Paul, who, at the age of 2, might have sucked on the binding, which was even more dangerous than reading it. Gretchen took the book and hid it under the carpet of her bedroom, where it was discovered by our housekeeper, Lena, who eventually handed it over to our mother. I'll make sure this is properly disposed of, my mother said, hurrying down the hallway to her bedroom. Thanking. She laughed, reading aloud from a randomly selected page. Oh, this ought to be good. Weeks later, Gretchen and I found the book hidden between the mattress and box spring of my parents' bed, the pages stained with coffee rings and cigarette ash. The discovery seemed to validate all of Gretchen's suspicions. They'll be coming for us any day now, she warned. I'd always made it a point to kiss my mother before going to bed, but not anymore. The feel of her hand on my shoulder now made my flesh crawl. She was hemming a pair of my pants one afternoon when, standing before her on a kitchen chair, I felt her hand graze my butt. I just want to be friends, I stammered. Nothing more, nothing less. She took the pins out of her mouth and studied me for a moment before sighing. Damn, and here you've been leading me on all this time. I read the book once more, trying to recapture my earlier pleasure, but it was too late now. I couldn't read the phrase, he punched his daughter's rock-hard knuckles, without thinking of Gretchen barricading herself in her room. I thought I might throw the book away or maybe even burn it, but like a perfectly good outgrown sweater, it seemed a shame to destroy it when the world was full of people who might get some use out of it. With this in mind, I carried the book to the grocery store parking lot and tossed it into the bed of a shining new pickup truck. Whistling out of apprehension and nervous relief, I took up my post beside the store's outdoor vending machine, waiting until the truck's owner returned pushing a cart full of groceries. He was a wiry man with fashionable mutton-chop sideburns and a half-cast on his arm. As he placed his bags in the back of the truck, his eyes narrowed upon the book. I watched as he picked it up and leafed through the first few pages before raising his head to search the parking lot, combing the area as if he might spot either a surveillance camera or preferably a vanload of naked swingers, pressing their bare breasts against the windows and inviting him to join the fun. He took a cigarette from his open pack and tapped it against the roof of his truck before lighting it. Then he slipped the book into his back pocket and drove away. Cyclops. When he was young, my father shot out his best friend's eye with a BB gun. That is what he told us. One foolish moment, and Jesus, if I could take it back, I would. He winced, shaking his fist as if it held a rattle. It eats me alive, he said. I mean to tell you that it absolutely tears me apart. On one of our summer visits to his hometown, My father took us to meet this guy, a shoe salesman whose milky pupil hugged the corner of his mangled socket. I watched the two men shake hands and turned away, sickened and ashamed by what my father had done. Our next-door neighbor received a BB gun for his 12th birthday and accepted it as a personal challenge to stalk and maim any living creature. Sunbathing cats, sparrows, slugs, and squirrels. If it moved, he shot it. I thought this was an excellent idea, but every time I raised a gun to my shoulder, I saw my father's half-blind friend stumbling forth with an armload of capizios. What would it be like to live with that kind of guilt? How could my father look himself in the mirror without throwing up? While watching television one afternoon, my sister Tiffany stabbed me in the eye with a freshly sharpened pencil. The blood was copious, and I rode to the hospital knowing that if I was blinded, my sister would be my slave for the rest of her life. Never for one moment would I let her forget what she'd done to me. There would be no swinging cocktail parties in her future, no poolside barbecues or episodes of carefree laughter, not one moment of joy. I would make sure of that. I'd planned my vengeance so thoroughly that I was almost disappointed when the doctor announced that this was nothing but a minor puncture wound, located not on, but beneath the eye. "Take a look at your brother's face," my father said, pointing to my Band-Aid. "You could have blinded him for life. Your own brother, a cyclops. Is that what you want?" Tiffany's suffering eased my pain for an hour or two, but then I began to feel sorry for her. "Every time you reach for a pencil, I want you to think about what you've done," my father said. "I want you to get on your knees and beg your brother to forgive you." There are only so many times a person can apologize before it becomes annoying. I lost interest long before the bandage was removed, but not my father. By the time he was finished, Tiffany couldn't lift a dull crayon without breaking into tears. Her pretty, suntanned face assumed the characteristics of a wrinkled, grease-stained bag. 6 years old and the girl was broken. Danger was everywhere, and it was our father's lifelong duty to warn us. Attending the country club's 4th of July celebration, we were told how one of his Navy buddies had been disfigured for life when a cherry bomb exploded in his lap. "Blew his balls right off the map," he said. "Take a second and imagine what that must have felt like." Racing to the farthest edge of the golf course, I watched the remainder of the display with my hands between my legs. Fireworks were hazardous, but thunderstorms were even worse. "I had a friend. Used to be a very bright, good-looking guy. He was on top of the world until the day he got struck by lightning. Caught him right between his eyes while he was trout fishing and cooked his brain just like you'd roast a chicken. Now he's got a metal plate in his forehead and can't even chew his own food. Everything has to be put in a blender and taken through a straw." In junior high, I signed up for shop class, and our first assignment was to build a napkin holder. "You're not going to be using a table saw, are you?" "I knew a guy, a kid about your size, who was using a table saw when the blade came loose, flew out of the machine, and sliced his face right in half." Using his index finger, my father drew an imaginary line from his forehead to his chin. "The guy survived, but nobody wanted anything to do with him. He turned into an alcoholic and wound up marrying a Chinese woman he'd ordered through a catalog. Think about it!" I did. My napkin holder was made from found boards and once finished, weighed in at close to 7 pounds. My bookshelves were even worse. "The problem with a hammer," I was told, "is that the head can fly off at any moment, and boy, let me tell you, you've never imagined pain like that." After a while, we began to wonder if my father had any friends who could still tie their own shoes or breathe without the aid of a respirator. With the exception of the shoe salesman, we'd never seen any of these people, only heard about them whenever one of us attempted to deep-fry chicken or operate the garbage disposal. "I've got a friend who buys a set of gloves and throws one of them away. He lost his right hand doing the exact same thing you're doing. He had his arm down the drain when the cat rubbed against the switch to the garbage disposal. Now he's wearing clip-on ties and having the restaurant waiters cut up his steak. Is that the kind of life you want for yourself? He allowed me to mow the lawn only because he was too cheap to pay a landscaper and didn't want to do it himself. What happened, he said, is that the guy slipped, probably on a pile of crap, and his leg got caught up in a blade. He found his foot, carried it to the hospital, but it was too late to sew it back on. Can you imagine that? The guy drove 15-20 miles with his foot in his lap. Regardless of the heat, I mowed the lawn wearing long pants, knee-high boots, a football helmet, and a pair of goggles. Before starting, I scouted the lawn for rocks and dog feces, carefully combing the area as if it had been mined. Even then, I pushed the mower haltingly, always fearing that this next step might be my last. Nothing bad ever happened, and within a few years I was mowing in shorts and sneakers, thinking of the supposed friend my father had used to illustrate his warning. I imagined this man jumping into his car and pressing on the accelerator with his bloody stump, a warm foot settled in his lap like a sleeping puppy. Why hadn't he just called an ambulance to come pick him up? How, in his shock, had he thought to search the weeds for his missing foot? It didn't add up. I waited until my junior year of high school to sign up for driver's education. Before taking to the road, we sat in the darkened classroom, watching films that might have been written and directed by my father. Don't do it, I thought, watching the prom couple attempt to pass a lumbering dump truck. Every excursion ended with the young driver wrapped around a telephone pole or burned beyond recognition, the camera focusing in on a bloody corsage littering the side of the highway. I drove a car no faster than I pushed a lawnmower, and the instructor soon lost patience. That license is going to be